Current state on 90.5 WKAR. According to this morning's Lansing State Journal, East Lansing police want to speak to the person who held the "Burn the Couch" sign at the Big Ten championship game on Saturday night. Reporter Matt Miller doesn't say whether that person could be charged with inciting a riot. But reading between the lines, what other conclusion are we supposed to come to? The police want to talk to him. That's all it says. I'll fess up. Watching the Big Ten championship on Saturday night, I saw the "Burn the Couch" sign in the stands at Lucas Oil Field. I laughed. I'll fess up. I'll be the first one. The burning couch has become a big, dumb icon of success and sometimes failure in Michigan State sports. But 57 fires, 15 arrests, maybe not so funny anymore. And the police are looking for others, too. DTN estimates damage to its properties at between $5,000 and $10,000. Not so funny. And I couldn't help but think of Graham Couch today. Graham Couch, the Lansing State Journal sports writer, and whether or not he might be reconsidering the name of his blog at the LSJ, Couch on Fire. Again, the first time I saw it, I laughed. LOL. It's Beavis and Butthead stuff. Just plain dumb, and sometimes so dumb you can't help but laugh. Maybe it's time to stop laughing. We'll keep an eye on it. Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Listening to Michigan's elected officials, it might be easy to assume that the only transportation issue facing the state is road funding. Indeed, there is agreement that road funding is particularly important, but it's just one of several priorities for our next guest. Tim Fisher is a member of the Transportation Policy Consortium, TRANSFORM, which stands for Transportation for Michigan. Tim is also the Deputy Policy Director at the Michigan Environmental Council. Other TRANSFORM priorities include more widespread commuter rail, a revitalized regional transportation in southeast Michigan, and reprioritizing how important transportation funding is spent. TRANSFORM just released a review of Michigan transportation developments in 2013, and to discuss those and TRANSFORM's future priorities, Tim Fisher, welcome to Current State.
Hi, Mark. Thanks a lot. It's great to be back.
First, explain TRANSFORM's connection to the Michigan Environmental Council. Y'all are connected in some way.
Yeah, we are. So TRANSFORM is a coalition. We're in our third year at this point, just wrapping up our third year. It is a coalition of about 65 different groups from around the state. These include economic development groups, transportation, public transportation interest groups, disability rights groups, environmental groups, and others. It is housed at the Michigan Environmental Council. We manage this project.
Is it really a brainchild of MEC then?
We house it. It's a brainchild of a variety of these different groups that have been working together over the decade or so on transportation issues. We were all called together by a few foundations, the Ford, Kresge, and C.S. Mott foundations, about 3 years ago. And they said we'd like to fund you to do something interesting and transformative around transportation issues. We want to see you work together. We want this to be a project of uncommon bedfellows, and we want success. So we pulled it together and have been going forward ever since. And I think at this point we're posed for success in a few different areas.
And we should explain TRANSFORM is it's spelled rather uniquely. It's rather eye catching. TRANS, the number 4, and then just the letter M. TRANSFORM. So there you go, Transportation for Michigan. We brought up road funding several times on Current State here in 2013 and the impasse over how to pay for road improvements in Michigan. But taking a wider view, what kind of year was it in transportation? From your perspective, was there progress on other initiatives, or was there more frustration than progress?
Yeah, I think there is considerable progress at the local level, and the funding issues remain, or the funding solutions remain elusive at the state level, I guess is one way of putting it. On the local level, we did a thing called the Transportation Odyssey. This is the third time that we've done this. And it's where we take public transit from one part of Michigan to the next. And so this year we started in Traverse City and went to Detroit using seven different transit providers. What we did, the theme of this Transportation Odyssey was groundbreakings, and so we wanted to celebrate all of the progress that had been done locally with transportation projects.
Was it hard to get from Traverse City to Detroit via public transportation?
Surprisingly, it's not all that difficult. When
really?
We first came up with this idea, we thought that you couldn't do it, and so we started exploring it, and then we found out, we actually can do it, and we have a good transportation network. It's a bare bones network, but it's a good foundation from which to build.
But it was really, the point was to celebrate what was happening along the way.
That's exactly right. And so in Traverse City, we started with the TART Trail Network, and we gave awards as we went. They've added 13 to 15 miles of new bicycle and pedestrian trails to their system. Commuters are using it to get to work. It's a great bike recreational path. There are developments along the path that have sidewalks leading directly to the path. It's really become a great asset to the community. It's knit different communities and areas of the city together. And so that we wanted to celebrate that success and to show other communities that this is something that they could install in their communities, both for recreation but also for people to walk and bike to work.
Sounds like you accentuate the positive. Obviously, the Odyssey was about accentuating the positive.
Yeah, right? That's right. And we went to Grand Rapids, and there we have Michigan's first new rapid transit system. It's called the Silver Line. It's 8 miles of dedicated bus rapid transit is what it's called. Not the best name in the world, but that's what we're stuck with.
And that Lansing's looking at that too.
Is looking at that as an option for the Michigan Avenue corridor. So this is, the other areas of the state will be looking to Grand Rapids's future success. I think it will be, of how to get these type of rapid transit facilities up and running. And it's a low-cost option compared to, say, a commuter rail system.
And right now in Lansing, CATA, the Capital Area Transportation Authority, is studying the environmental impact of a bus rapid transit line from Michigan and Grand River Avenues. Now, does a development like that have a place in your review for 2013? It certainly sounds like the kind of thing that Transform would support.
Yeah, it certainly is, and we will be tracking the progress with great interest, especially once they get a little farther along and start looking at the alternatives and the routes. But this is exactly the type of project that we want to see replicated where feasible around the state.
Explain what bus rapid transit is, though, exactly.
And so what it's been kind of ineloquently described as trains on rubber tires. And so there will be dedicated stations. You go through a turnstile, say, like you were going into a subway. You'll have a ticket. You walk through. The platforms are level with the bottom of the bus, and so it's great for wheelchair users, for elderly. You walk directly from the platform onto the bus, and the bus takes off in a dedicated lane. It is part of it's within the current right of way, typically of the roadway. At certain times, it will be designated only for the rapid bus to drive in. Other times of the day when it's not as busy, other traffic can typically travel in those lanes.
But it's one form of transportation, right? It's not bus and rapid transit. It's not some combination. It is this one thing
it
that
is
you
a,
just described.
Yes, it is a one. It's a kind of an extended bus. You might have seen them around particularly campus. The long articulated buses is typically the length of the bus that they use for the rapid transit routes. So this is it's a very interesting alternative to a commuter rail, considerably less expensive. You don't have the cost of installing the tracks. And we've seen in other parts of the country that it's really triggered economic development, boosted real estate property values along the route, similar to what you'd see in a fixed guideway system, a subway or a commuter rail type situation.
Lansing is still years away from this, though, correct? Isn't this part of a multi-year process?
Yes, these projects take a long time to develop, to engineer, to seek, to find funding for. To pay for. So it's a ways away, but it all starts with the planning, and they have a great start.
We're talking with Tim Fisher of the transportation policy group Transform, based here in Lansing. Are you watching developments like the Michigan Grand River Design Charrette, that larger development, the transformation of the area from the Capitol to Weberville?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're watching with interest, and our groups have been involved at various points along the process. Yeah, this is a great start. This is the kind of visioning we would like to see replicated in other communities. The Traverse City area had done something similar many years ago, led by one of our groups up there. So it's important for communities to envision what they want for themselves, transportation, land use, how they want to develop. That can help guide their development and make investments in a more strategic way.
Has Transform made particular recommendations with regard to the Michigan Grand River project?
We have not made particular recommendations. No, we think that it's proceeding, as it should, with a robust public engagement. We'd like to see that type of engagement replicated, for instance, in the Detroit region with the new regional transit authority. They too are looking at least conceptually, a bus rapid transit network within the four county and city region. So that this is an important work. It's great that communities around the state are learning how to do this and learning how to do it effectively.
I take it the establishment of the RTA, which took place this year, is one of the more encouraging developments of 2013.
Oh, yeah.
This is Southeast Michigan, at least.
This is a huge success. It's been, we've counted 23 different times that we've attempted to get the RTA up and running. This time it was a success with a great, and forceful backing by the governor that helped considerably.
What will it mean? What does the establishment of the RTA mean, and where does the future lay here?
Yeah, this isn't the most sexy thing that we have. It really is. It's a mechanism by which federal and state money can flow to different transit authorities. It has it holds the purse strings. It has the ability to force efficiencies and coordinations within each of the systems. To make those systems work much more effectively for the riders and to have our tax money go farther more effectively.
When might we see the impact of the creation of the RTA?
Yeah, it's one of these things that we will see it. It won't be a huge ribbon cutting type thing. I think the impact is already being felt. There's more money flowing into DDOT now, in part because of some of the bankruptcy restructuring, but also because there have been federal loans that have been sitting in Washington that have not flown to the city's transportation department. Those are now starting to flow. So I think we'll see this type of progress as we go forward. Some of the efficiencies of they might focus more buses on some of the more popular routes, less buses on some of the least popular routes, might do some schedule change and coordination, which is really kind of the technical and mechanical aspects of making these systems work well and together.
One of the newest policy campaigns Transform is working on focuses on transportation via trains. Michigan by Rail focuses on a proposed rail line from Detroit all the way to Holland. Talk to us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, and so the Michigan by Rail project started a few years ago. We held a series of 16 or 17 public forums around the state. We collected public comments from just about 1,200 residents about what they wanted to see in their rail transportation system. One of the things that rose quickly to the top in all of these forums was people really wanted to see a way of connecting our principal metro regions, at least in southern Michigan, and that's the Detroit metropolitan area, the Lansing region, and Grand Rapids. This is a passenger rail route that was very popular and successful up until about the 70s. It was abandoned in part when shortly after Amtrak took over the passenger rail network for the country, and there is now renewed interest to reestablish that route. And so what we're looking to put together is a corridor coalition. We'll be engaging hospitals and the universities. There are actually over 10 to 12 different colleges and universities right along this route.
We're just about out of time, Tim. Yep. I want to close with just one quick question. Is the wider, broader public on board? Are they participating in this conversation, or would you like to see more?
We'd like to see more. We always want to see more public engagement and public participation, and that's what we'll be aiming to do with this campaign.
Interesting conversation with all kinds of impacts, potential impacts for Michigan's and Lansing's future. Tim Fisher is a member of the Transportation Policy Consortium, TRANSFORM, which stands for Transportation for Michigan. Thanks, Tim. Good
Thanks
luck.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. With the start of Michigan's winter season, which can seem eternal, many of us may be taking refuge in seed catalogs or planning for next summer's gardens. Something else you might see is in an increasing number of yards. Namely, hives of bees. Backyard beekeeping, especially in urban areas, is seeing an upsurge in popularity. And joining us now to talk about trends in beekeeping is Dr. Roger Hoopengarner. Roger was a faculty member of the Department of Entomology at Michigan State University for 38 years and remains active in the beekeeping world. Welcome to Current State.
Good morning, Mark.
Nice to see you. We've heard a lot the past few years about a bee crisis, colony collapses, and a reduction in the bee population. What is the state of the North American bee as we speak?
Well, it's still in great trouble. We don't know the real problem. It's probably a factor of lots of mites, diseases, and things that have come into this country in the last 40 years from overseas. And it may be a perfect storm, and that is all of these diseases and parasites that have come together to affect the honeybee is just causing this colony collapse disorder. Mm. It may be other things, but we have never yet found out what they are.
Does that concern you as a beekeeper?
Oh, absolutely. We're still losing about 30% of our bees every winter. And this winter already we've lost lots of bees, early, which is earlier than normal. So we still are in great trouble.
Are we talking one species here, or various?
We're talking about the honeybee, but it also seems to, the population of bumblebees and wild bees are also down. And we don't know for sure quite why all of those are suffering at the same time.
Now, as a beekeeper, how do you contend with that?
Well, it's difficult because we have to sometimes replace our bees that die over winter. And we usually do this by getting bees from the south, which has a season advanced of ours. And so they produce bees for us in the north. So they ship them in packages or in colonies. And so it's a way of getting bees, replacing our bees. We also get some swarms from other colonies that are feral colonies that are in trees that reproduce by swarming. And we pick those up and use those to start colonies as well.
How many different species are native to mid-Michigan?
When we're talking about bees, I can't answer that exactly because I'm not a real taxonomist, but probably 300 or 400 solitary bees are native. There are bumblebee species that are native. Actually, the honeybee is not native.
We're in the hundreds?
Oh, yes.
Hundreds of different species of bees in mid-Michigan?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Now, some of these are, I wouldn't say rare, but uncommon, and others that are maybe more common. There are certainly bumblebee species that are very, very common. They're just found everywhere.
Do they serve the same function in terms of the environment and ecology?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And they all pollinate.
Pollination.
Yeah. They use pollen for raising their brood, and that's how they get. They go out and search for nectar and pollen, but mostly pollen. The solitary bees are mostly pollen to feed their young.
How long have you kept bees in your backyard or property that you have, a farm?
Various places. This is my 65th year of keeping bees.
Wow.
Yeah.
A real noticeable transition in recent years, then.
Oh, absolutely.
It sounds like it.
Oh, yes. Yeah. We first picked up one of the original parasites in 1985, or recognized it at least in 1985. And so it's been fairly recent that we've had real troubles.
How many bees do you manage then?
I only have one colony in my backyard now.
And that's how many bees?
Oh, it usually gets to be 45,000-50,000 in the middle of the summer.
Wow.
Right now, in this time of the year, it's probably down to 25,000 or 30,000.
Okay, but some of those you will be replacing here in towards spring then? Or how does this play out? If you are losing part of your brood, then how? What's the timeline like? When do you actually address that?
Bees are honeybees, as we know them, are a tropical animal that have learned to live in the north by what we call clustering. And they just get together in a big mass and generate heat. And if we look at inside of a colony right today, the center of that cluster is probably 85 degrees. As soon as they start raising brood about the first of the year, that will go to 95 degrees and stay there all through the rest of the summer because that's the brood-rearing temperature, 95 degrees.
So if they weren't originally strictly a tropical animal to start out.
They were originally a tropical animal, and they learned to live in the north by doing this
adaptation.
Clustering. It took them probably eons, but they did learn to do that. And as I say, honeybee is not native to this country either. We brought them in when the colonists arrived. They all of a sudden realized they didn't have sugar or honey, and they didn't have beeswax for their candles. And so they immediately sent notice back to the old world, hey, we need bees. And so they originally brought bees over.
Amazing. We're talking with Dr. Roger Hoopengarner, who was a faculty member of the Department of Entomology at MSU for 38 years and has been keeping bees himself for 65 years, you said?
Yes.
That's fantastic. What do you find a greater interest then in backyard beekeeping here in the Lansing area?
That's the fascinating thing. It's really all over the country, Mark. As the bee population has gone down and the stories have gone out about this colony collapse disorder, people have gotten really kind of interested in bees. And so while the number of bees maybe has gone down, the number of beekeepers has gone up greatly. Now I'm talking about the hobbyist, the backyard beekeeper. We, last spring at our spring ANR week, Agricultural Natural Week meeting, we had over 650 people attend that meeting, and that was at Michigan State here.
But that doesn't have a, how big an impact does that have on the overall bee population?
Probably a minor, because commercial beekeepers still own probably 85 or 90% of all the bees. Mm. I mean, the total number of colonies of bees, just the number of beekeepers has increased greatly.
Mm-hmm. What about the different regulations regarding hives? I'm led to believe that different areas have different regulations. How does that play out here in Lansing?
Well, if we have, you'll find that local townships and cities may have ordinances against having bees in your backyard. Many of them do not, as long as they're not a nuisance. It just depends a little on the township or the local community. Sometimes we have to get those modified. Probably you noticed in New York City now allows bees in New York City, and that was a law that was changed about 2 years ago, maybe a little longer than that. But it was prohibited to have bees in New York City. Bees were there because beekeepers did it kind of surreptitiously. They would have them roof of their apartment, and people didn't even know they had them.
Tough law to enforce.
Yes.
Do you think the growing interest in amateur beekeeping is as a result of word spreading of colony collapse disorder? Is this actually a response to that?
I can't answer that really because I haven't felt that myself because I'd already kept bees. But I think so. I think it's people are, maybe I can help. That kind of, the environment. If I kept a few bees, maybe that would help. And maybe I'll learn something and be able to add something to the scientific knowledge about bees that keeps them healthy.
Is this a backyard pursuit for you, or do you own a farm or what?
This is a backyard pursuit for me. Mm-hmm. And typically, I say most of our beekeepers are very small, have one or two colonies in their backyard. They may, there are some that have, say, one or two in their backyard, but also have another half a dozen out on their friend's farm, that's local, nearby. So that's a way of keeping bees as well.
It's an awfully cold day out. I mean, we're into the winter season without a doubt. What happens in the wintertime here?
Well, the bees, as I say, have a mass and a cluster, and the outer shell of that bees kind of limits the heat dissipating. But they eat honey and metabolize, and they actually shiver, if you can use that term, to generate this heat. And so the center of that cluster will be 85 degrees today. The outer shell may be only 40 or 45 degrees, and so the bees are barely moving because they're just...
But they survive.
But they survive.
They can survive. Right. That's just enough heat for the bee to survive. Boy, that is adaptation.
It is.
For a tropical animal to survive 40 degrees for months on end whatever.
Yes, they keep bees in Canada, there's maybe 150, 170, 80 days without flying, and so they learn how to... have adapted to this cold weather.
Extraordinary pursuit, an extraordinary animal. If somebody has an interest in this and maybe wants to get their feet wet slowly, what do you recommend?
Well, first off, get to know a beekeeper if you can. For example, we have a local beekeepers club that meets at the pavilion every second Monday at 6:30. And you just go out there and get to talking to beekeepers and then... read some books. There are lots of videos now on YouTube and things like that, and they can study that. They have to then probably buy some equipment and bees to get started. But knowing a beekeeper will help that transition greatly.
Interesting. I drive by on Mount Hope Avenue in Okemos. I drive past a stretch of road every day, and now that the leaves have all fallen, there is a branch hanging out over the road, and there is the most enormous bee's nest that has become revealed since the leaves fell. And I drive underneath this thing, and I think at some point this thing's going to drop.
It's actually probably a paper wasp nest.
Oh no, not a bee's nest. Probably a wasp. Okay.
And those are dead now.
Okay.
But okay. The nest itself is still there, but the bees or the wasp themselves are still
very
there.
Good. I'm glad we could clarify that. Dr. Roger Hoopengarner was a member of the Department of Entomology at MSU for 38 years and is still an active amateur beekeeper. Roger, thanks for joining us.
My welcome. My pleasure.
Coming up on Current State, we're off to Jackson and the Ella Sharp Museum. There's an exhibit of American Impressionists that is coming to the Ella Sharp Museum in Jackson. Scott Pohl will check in. He took a tour of it here just a few days ago, and we'll learn all about it. It's Current State on WKAR. It's safe to say most of us take for granted that when we turn on our faucets, clean water comes out. But where does our drinking water come from? How clean is it? And how much responsibility do we as individuals have to ensure that our water stays clean? Well, here to help us understand how we interact with our local fresh water is Rachel Laux. Rachel is the watershed coordinator for the Eaton Conservation District, and she's leading a new campaign called Pollution Isn't Pretty to raise awareness about how our behaviors impact drinking water. Rachel, welcome to Current State.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about the Eaton Conservation District. This is a county organization?
Yep. So Eaton Conservation District primarily works out of Eaton County on natural resource issues, anywhere from water resources, such as what I work on, to agriculture and helping people reduce their environmental risks, to environmental education. So we are out there helping folks make better decisions and stay informed. I'm a watershed coordinator, and so I work on the Middle Grand River watershed, which actually covers multiple counties. So I work in Ingham, Eaton, Clinton, and Ionia counties and work on informing people about what's going on in that watershed and what the state of the water quality is like right now.
And what are our main sources for drinking water here in the Lansing area?
So our main source of drinking water is actually groundwater. So our drinking water comes from deep under the surface in a groundwater well. So whether you live in the city of Lansing or out in the country in a private well, all of your water is coming from groundwater. Mm-hmm. And so that's our primary source.
And what is the generally... what's the condition of that groundwater in our area?
So in our area, we do a really great job at protecting our drinking water. So our drinking water is very clean and safe, and it's not generally something that we would have to worry about in terms of being harmful. What I work on is surface water. So surface water is water that flows across the land that's in our rivers and streams. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of pollution that this campaign is focused on. So our drinking water is very well taken care of and in good hands.
Okay. Now, does surface water ever make it to the water table, though?
They do mingle in the water cycle, yes. So they are connected in that way. So protecting our surface water is important for our groundwater resource, for sure.
And talk to us about this word watershed. Mm-hmm. I see this all over the place, and I have this kind of fuzzy idea of what it means. What is a watershed exactly?
So a watershed, it sounds complicated, but to make it really simple, basically all of the water that flows across our land ends up in one spot. So all the water in the mid-Michigan area ends up in what we would call the Middle Grand River watershed. So it's flowing across the land into our rivers and streams, which then are eventually connected to Lake Michigan.
Now, when drinking water does get polluted, where does the pollution come from?
It can come from a variety of sources. A lot of times when drinking water is contaminated, it can come from things like nutrients or even sometimes bacteria are generally the pollutants that we tend to worry about with our drinking water.
And generally, what's the condition of the Middle Grand River watershed?
So the Middle Grand River watershed has definitely improved drastically. I always tell people, you know, a long time ago, our rivers used to catch on fire. That no longer happens.
the Cuyahoga, right?
Yeah, right. But We definitely still have an impact. You know, the more densely populated we become and the more developed we become, we as people have a larger impact. But it's definitely a lot better than what it used to be, and we'll never probably get to zero impact. But we still have some things to work on as far as making sure that it's in good health.
We're talking with Rachel Laux, who's the watershed coordinator for the Eaton Conservation District. I know one big issue is impermeable surfaces, mm-hmm. rooftops, parking lots, roadways, where impurities gather, road sludge, chemicals, all manner of impurities gather, and they can't sink down into the earth, so they run to some nearby stream or river. How do you contend with that?
That is definitely a challenge.
That's one of the big issues you're mm-hmm. really right now in terms of urban areas,
yep.
settled areas, right?
Yes, absolutely. In our urban areas, that's definitely a big problem. There are what I would call simple fixes to that. You know, doing things like planting trees, installing rain gardens, green roofs, slowing that water down makes a big difference in what the quality of the water once it reaches our streams, what that's like. So there are definitely things that we can do. A homeowner, for example, could, instead of having a completely turf grass lawn, they could plant a lot of native plants, and that would help in that process. So taking a lot of little steps will help in the long run.
And what are you trying to get done here with your Pollution Isn't Pretty campaign? You're trying to raise awareness here.
Yep, absolutely. So the Pollution Isn't Pretty campaign is about getting people to realize that we are connected to our water resources no matter where we're at, and that pollution comes in many different forms, and that there are actions and small steps we can take to have a positive impact on our water resources. A lot of times when we think about pollution, we point to things like factories and manufacturing, and we forget that we as individuals have a significant impact on our water. And that's what this campaign is really about, is reminding individuals that we do have an impact, and we can choose to make that positive or negative.
If you could select one or two behaviors that the average person needs to become more aware of, what would they be?
A big one, and I will admit that I'm a pet owner myself, but a big one is picking up your dog waste if you're out about town,
yeah.
walking your pet. That's a pretty big problem and a very simple, easy thing to do. Another great one is, you know, being mindful of where you're washing your car. So don't wash your car in your driveway. Wash it where there's grass so that water can soak in and through natural processes, clean itself up. Those are two pretty simple, easy things that we can do.
What about people like me who love a nice green yard?
So that is definitely a challenge for us in water quality. Having a green yard isn't necessarily a bad thing. Being mindful of how much fertilizer you're using, do you need to even fertilize? So mm-hmm. getting your soil tested is something that you can do and is really easy. Another thing you could do is kind of compromise and maybe have half of your lawn in a green turf grass and then half of it in more native plants that help soak up that water and infiltrate it into the ground.
And tell us a little bit more about the Pollution Isn't Pretty campaign. What are you really trying to get done here, and how are you doing it?
So what we're trying to get done is, on a very simple level, is just to raise awareness and then to help people make better choices. So to offer suggestions like native plants in their lawn, picking up after their pet waste. And we're doing that through social media and websites, and then hopefully doing some things like billboards and raising awareness that way. And it's really just about getting people to think twice about their actions and make better choices.
You must have been encouraged when we could start fishing again in the Red Cedar River last spring.
Yes, that was a wonderful thing to see.
It's been a long time.
Very excited. Mm-hmm.
That's right. Well, Rachel Laux is the watershed coordinator for the Eaton Conservation District. Rachel's leading a new campaign called Pollution Isn't Pretty to help raise awareness about how we impact our local water resources. Rachel, good luck. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And this environmental segment of Current State is sponsored by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. For more news of the Great Lakes environment, you can check out greatlakesecho.org. Say the words Impressionist art, and you're likely to think of the Europeans like Monet, Manet, Renoir, Degas, and Cézanne. But a number of American artists fit in that category, too. In Jackson, the Ella Sharp Museum has opened an exhibition called American Impressionism, The Lure of the Artist's Colony. It's on loan from the Reading Public Museum in Pennsylvania, and current state Scott Pohl recently explored the exhibition. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Mark.
Tell us a little bit about what you saw.
Well, there are 55 pieces on display from what the museum describes as the Golden Age of American Impressionism, the 1880s through the 1930s. Being far from an expert myself, I decided to take Laura Smith with me to Jackson. She's an assistant professor of art and art history at MSU. I asked her to speculate on why the Americans are less well-known than the European Impressionists.
The way I would respond to that maybe has more to do with people's love of color and light, and how the vivid strength of that comes out more in the French Impressionism than in American Impressionism. American Impressionist tends to have a tonal palette which can seem darker. I think at the time, at the Golden Age of Impressionism, they certainly were well-known and highly revered, especially in contrast to the European movements of abstraction that were coming over and really criticized by most American artists and critics.
Which American artist maybe would you say should be more widely known or appreciated?
I think the most well-known are Childe Hessem and John Singer Sargent. And they certainly have their audience and reputation. And most are recognized as Impressionists, but I think they're so different. I think that we do kind of have Monet and the French Impressionism as our marker of the convention, perhaps. And because American Impressionists stray away from those French Impressionists, that they aren't as well known for that reason. So there's certainly many of them in this room, in this exhibit, right now, who have, you know, fabulous renditions of landscape and light and color.
Did the American Impressionists exist in the same circles as the Europeans? Did they know each other, work together, appreciate each other?
That's what these art colonies were about, were coming together, not just painters, but musicians and writers, and sharing ideas and seeing everybody's latest work. And artists of the day still spent a lot of time in Europe and going to study. I mean, they had the best art schools at the time, and that was part of your training. I mean, if you wanted to make it as an artist, you had to go over and spend time in Europe and study with those. And so that's where they are coming into contact with French Impressionism, and also, you know, collectors are bringing them over and doing exhibitions beginning in the 1880s for the United States.
Well, the exhibition is called American Impressionism, The Lure of the Artist's Colony. I wanted to bring that up with you in regard to the typical image of the solitary artist working alone somewhere. The artist colony movement took that in an entirely different direction. People worked together, observed each other, learned from each other in these colonies.
These were seasonal colonies. They would come during the summertime to spend time out in nature, to get away from the cities, to get there was a lot of, in American culture, promotion for people to get away from cities, at least among the middle class, to rid yourself of the stresses of cities, the illnesses that were very common in cities, and get reinvigorated. And so artists, you know, followed their patrons out to the country, as well as returned with them to the cities for the rest of the year.
There were a number of them in the United States, and this exhibition, in some fashion anyway, is designed around different colonies. For instance, we're standing in front of some works from Old Lyme, and we're next to the Massachusetts art colonies here as well. They were all over the country.
Yeah, they originated in the East Coast, but there's notable ones in Santa Fe and Taos and in California.
I want to talk with you about a few of the individual pieces here, and I thought I might begin with this piece called On Grand River by Frank Weston Benson. I wanted to make a point of talking with you about it because it's the piece that was chosen by the Ella Sharp Museum to promote this exhibition. On Golden River by Frank Weston Benson.
I think this probably pulled together some of the important elements of what artists were interested in when they're going out into these art colonies, getting away from cities. We don't see any evidence of, you know, buildings or factories or things, and we see a man making his way in a canoe through the river using almost old-time transportation, pre-industrial transportation. There's a lot about these artists that were interested in this moment of history, you know, kind of clinging to and being nostalgic about that historic moment of before industry, and many of them looking back to things that seemed very enduring, that would offer them stability and comfort. And who wouldn't feel that sense of comfort and restfulness going out on a river, going fishing, getting away from everything, and having these kind of solitary moments to restore yourself? I mean, and that's certainly what a lot of these artists were looking for. This painting by Irving Kaus is titled Indian Hunter. He being among some of the early artists going out to Taos, New Mexico, to paint certainly a beautiful landscape, but also being very interested in the indigenous culture in the area. People who kind of represented, again, to him and to a lot of the artists in the Taos colony, a culture that seemed pre-industrial. So this nostalgia and revere for a time in the country before industrialization, this nostalgia for that. This is an interesting one, an artist I'm not as familiar with, Paulette Van Rockens, Towers in the Mist. This seems very typical of some of the American Impressionists who worked in more of a tonal palette, that is, ones that were more grayed down rather than the typical French Impressionist palette being very high key color or strong chromatic colors in that way, as well as, you know, exploiting the use of gray days or stormy days to dissolve form, so that there were other ways to dissolve form which Impressionists were interested in besides short, quick brush marks, where you're kind of seeing form dissolve and come back in light, and exploiting the steam, what you think must be, you know, the coal fire smoke, and turning it into more clouds to dissolve those forms, or the wetness of the pavement here. You know, not as strong as vivid color as we just saw with the other painting, but one that is impressionistic in its sketchy brushwork.
It's interesting that we've gone from scenes of solitude and getting back to nature to a busy city landscape with towers, rain falling, cars moving, bustling pedestrians.
Exactly, and this was, you know, the how many of them started out, and this is where they were. The other parts of the year that they weren't out in the summer was back in the cities and recording moments of modern life as they were happening. This painting by Guy Carlton Wiggins, Gloucester at Twilight, is one of very appealing ones. It's one that kind of is hung right at the beginning of the exhibition and captures, again, this scene, you know, of village life, small town life, which the artists, especially in the eastern colonies in New England, were very attracted to this life, again, away from cities. And, you know, here I'm seeing ships in the harbor, but perhaps not your most modern mechanized ships, but it looks like the old sailboats almost. And then in the background, taller buildings that are church steeples. Again, these symbols of enduring, what they perceive to be an enduring American values, at least to this class and race of artists, Euro-American artists, that they were looking to, you know, things that seem to be enduring, and that was a cause to a lot of them a lot of anxiety. There was a lot of quick cultural change, and you know, looking back again to this moment before industry, perhaps to the origins of the country, which many of them could trace their own origins back to, you know, the Puritans, the original settlers.
How often are the American Impressionists exhibited like this? And what I'm getting at is this, as I might guess, a rare opportunity to see the works of American Impressionists gathered here in Jackson?
I would think so. Impressionists in this country, I think, are very popular. And something that, you know, even my students in class, I mean, everybody kind of breathes a sigh of relief when they finally get to Impressionism, because they know it. They've seen it. They love it. They love the color. They love nature, as, you know, many of us do. A lot of Americans have a deep regard for wilderness, and especially in Michigan, you know, getting out to our state parks and to the coastline and being in our boats. I mean, I think that there is something that's very appealing, and that people in Michigan and Americans in general connect with.
The exhibition is called American Impressionism, The Lure of the Artist's Colony. It's at the Ella Sharp Museum in Jackson through January 11th. Laura Smith is an MSU Assistant Professor of Art and Art History at MSU. Thank you for joining me for this trip to Jackson today.
Thank you. I've been delighted to be here.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And one final note today, General Motors has announced that Dan Akerson, the automaker's chairman and CEO, will retire. Next month, he'll be succeeded by Mary Barra, GM's Executive Vice President of Global Product Development. Mary Barra will become the first CEO of any major automaker. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we take a look back with a time capsule. Also, our Neighbors in Action segment features the East Lansing Rotary Club. That and more tomorrow on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thank you for listening to Current State on WKAR.